So how many of have anyone gathered around this table seen La La Land yet?
I haven't seen it, and I'm getting a bit of grief at home because Rachel has this theory that it's, you know, Oscar bait because it's set in LA. But I am a huge fan of the film that I discover from the Twitters that you're also a huge fan of, which Les Parapluies de Cherbourg.
Yes, Les Parapluies de Cherbourg is one of my favourite films.
Incredibly knowledgeable film buffy wife has never seen. So,
well, you know,
I feel I'm slightly ahead of the game on this because it does seem to be an homage to.
But he says that. The thing about La La Land is...
Is he French, the director?
No, he's American.
But he sounds French.
So the thing about Jacques Demian Chazelle. Demian Chazelle. He's made this film, and he hasn't quite said this, but Jacques Demy makes The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, wonderful film, French musical. Then he makes another film called Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, yeah. Young Girls of Rochefort, another wonderful film. And Hollywood comes calling. And they say to him in the late 60s, Jacques, to America,
carte blanche.
The film you want. You can make what you want. And he makes a film called Model Shop, which is...
Never heard of it.
A disaster. It's not a musical. It is incredibly odd.
Horrible.
It's known in the industry as Model Flop for many years. And Jacques Demy never gets to make another film in the States. And you can watch La La Land and think, oh, okay, I'll tell you what this is. This is somebody making the film they wish Jacques Demy had made when he got to Hollywood. So it's set in Hollywood and it has all these references to the MGM musicals. But it's so like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And so like The Young Girls of Rochefort. I mean, I really loved it.
Great. Should we start this mofo? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. We're gathered cosily around the kitchen table in the distressed brickwork bedecked offices of our sponsors, Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something special. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us round that table are not one, but two special guests this time for a unique episode of Backlisted in both its subject and the promise that has been made that it will be exceptionally foul-mouthed. the first guest is Dr. Una McCormack, a lecturer in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin University. She is also the New York Times best-selling author. That, by your own admission.
That's true.
That.
It's
yeah, New York Times best-selling author. She has a sideline in writing novels based on TV and movie franchises.
That's right.
Such as?
Star Trek.
Amazing.
Doctor Who. And this will test your age, Blake Seven.
Oh,
and you, and you, of all the people gathered around this table, you are the one who knows most about Blake Seven. Although I know a bit about Blake Seven.
Usually, that's true around any table.
It's funny when I go to the Blake Seven folder in my brain and open it, I find there's almost nothing in there.
Watching the DVDs.
I must have watched many episodes in my young, you know, life.
There are 52.
Oh, they're incredible. Isn't that the same as Star Trek 75, isn't it? The original.
I can't remember.
Our Georgette Hare episode will follow in several hours' time.
Yes, we should say that our other guest is Kathy Rensenbrink. Kathy is an author and associate editor of The Bookseller, and like all the best people, a graduate of the Waterstones Academy for people who sell books well.
Oh.
Her memoir, The Last Act of Love, about the death of her brother, was published to great acclaim last year.
It's a wonderful book. One of the great books of recent
publishing, and we're very, very pleased to have both of you here.
The book Kathy and Una have come in to talk about is historic in several ways. It's historic because it is a period romance.
Regency.
Venetia by Georgette Hare. But it's also historic because only three men in history have ever read this book. Stephen Fry, John Mitchison and myself.
I must say, it's the achievement of my life that I have made you both read Georgette Hare. I think that is spectacular. I'm done. I'm giving up. No matter what else happens in the whole rest of my life. On the gravestone.
The thought of Andy reading Venetia over the last few weeks has sustained me.
It was one of the things that slightly kept me going, I have to say, imagining Andy reading it going...
I did, I'm going to say, I'm showing my hand already. I really enjoyed it.
Also, the other part of our deal was that Andy was going to read Venetia and I was going to read Anita Bruckner's first novel, which I now can't remember what it is. And also, I haven't read it yet.
It's called A Start in Life, and backlisted listeners will be heartily sick of me banging on about Anita Bruckner. But anyway.
And I do feel a bit ashamed I haven't read it yet, but I also think, well, there's probably not many arenas in which Georgette Heyer beats over Anita Bruckner, so we're giving one for her.
I'll give you that, yeah. But before we talk about that...
Yes, Andy.
Yes.
What have you been reading this week?
Well, coincidentally, and it is a coincidence, I've been reading a book by our former guest on Backlisted, Samantha Ellis. She was on here talking about Lolly Willows and Sylvia Townsend Warner. She was great.
One of the great discoveries of last year, for me anyway.
Her last book was called How to Be a Heroine. We talked a little bit about that when she was on. That is a bibliomemoir, terrific book. Anyway, she's got a new book out, which is the book I've been reading. It's called Take Courage, Anne Bronte and the Art of Life. And the combination of reading this and watching To Walk Invisible, Sally Wainwright's film over Christmas, I sort of had a crash course in the Brontes. I don't think I've ever really had. And the thing about the Brontes is it's so... Their lives are so incident-packed. I'm just going to read you out this one little... There's a story. Before we talk about Samantha's book, there's a story on page 67 of this book, which, if it were an event that happened to you in your life... or the life of someone you knew, would be the defining event in their life. And here it is, just this is in passing. Anne was at school when Patrick was shouted down at the 1837 Haworth election hustings and 20-year-old Branwell tried to intervene. The village made an effigy of Branwell with a potato in one hand and a herring in the other and carried it through Main Street before burning it. I mean, if you had been burnt in effigy by the age of 21, that would be enough to fuel an entire book, wouldn't it? But that's just a passing detail in this. What Samantha does in this book, which is so good, is she manages to make it about Anne Bronte.
Is she the eldest?
She is the youngest.
The youngest, that's
she
right.
is the author of Agnes Grey and The Tenant
so
of
So it goes
Wildfell
Charlotte,
Hall.
Emily, Anne.
Yeah, that's right. And so although the book is about Anne, it's about the history of the Brontes. It's like a compendium of stories about all members of the family. Mm. A Brontesaurus, if you will.
Very nice.
You've been polishing that all week.
Gets up from table, walks out the door.
They were really called Bronte, though, weren't they? Do you know that?
Well, they were really called all sorts of different things before Patrick Bronte... It fixed
it was,
upon.
It was to do
even
with Nelson the, had a some. Wasn't it some to mark some medal that Nelson had been given? Oh. I can't remember. He was
I
the
thought
Duke
he just thought it sounded too Irish in Cambridge.
That's odd. Maybe I don't know.
It's that as well, isn't it?
Brunty. Yeah.
I think they had an Irish father, Cornish mother, like me, which is why. Really? That's why I've retained that piece of information.
But it's also a quite passionate book about Anne Bronte and the extent to which Anne Bronte has been marginalised traditionally in the way the Brontes are written about. But also, Samantha does a really good thing, which I think is quite risky because the extent to which it might not work is quite high, of putting herself into the book in such a way as to personalise the story that she's telling you while she does it. And it's making those three elements balance out. Which is, I think, what's so good about the book. It really moved. I found it very moving. Kathy, you've read it, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I just loved it, and it was such a treat. It was a treat. I read it. I was on the road doing various festivals, and of course, having to, you know, I'd read all the books already, but then having to sort of like revise three books for a panel that afternoon, another three books, and that was the book I was reading when I was just reading for my own pleasure. That was no job, and it was just beautiful. It was like it palate cleansed me and intrigued and amused me all at the same time. I did think Charlotte doesn't come out of it tremendously well. I didn't feel
she doesn't. I don't think she's terribly keen on Charlotte while acknowledging her as a great writer because she. The portrait she paints of Charlotte in this book is of somebody who was sort of... With that famous phrase about Paul McCartney and George Harrison, that Paul McCartney was always 2 years older than George Harrison and never let George Harrison forget it. In fact, Sam has a brilliant comparison in this book. Do you remember? She has a brilliant comparison in this book where she says, like... It's been Anne Bronte's sad lot in life to be the George Harrison of the Brontes.
Yeah.
Right, so you've got Emily as the Lennon figure and Charlotte as the controlling McCartney figure.
I thought you were going to polish off
Bramwell is Stuart Sutcliffe.
Victor Lewis Smith's great line, you know, the Beatles are dying in the wrong order.
I really love the book, and I recommend it just as a really
fresh
way.
And is it just coincidence? It's not connected to the TV show at all. It's just...
No, not at all. But, I mean, the Brontes are always with us, aren't they?
So. And her book, How to Be a Heroine, is also
like the poor.
Yes. And I really like that style of sort of literary criticism with some personal memoir threaded through.
Yeah.
Very readable, very enjoyable. Feels like a conversation. So I would just read her on anything, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
She could say, I've got a book out next year. It's about... X, and I'd say, yes, please.
I'm always a bit nervous when people do the putting yourself in a in a book, but memories of the ghastliness of Peter Ackroyd's fictional interpolations in his Dickens biography. Apologies, Mr. Ackroyd, if you're listening, but they were howling. I mean, it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Didn't work. But it sounds great. I mean, I think... Like you say, they are always with us, but their lives were just remarkable, weren't they?
I mean, there's always something, that's the point, I mean, one of the reasons why they're always with us, because there are always new ways to talk about them and new ways to interpret them. Have you ever read The Tenants of Wildfell Hall?
No, I have not. Is it good?
I read it last year. I absolutely loved it.
Great.
And actually, it's very difficult. I think if you read this book about Anne Bronte and you haven't read The Tenants of Wildfell Hall, you sort of can't...
Yeah. I always want to.
You'll want to read it so much.
She
after
lived
finishing
in Scarborough for quite a long time, where my mum lived for a while, or my dad and mum lived for a while.
She died in Scarborough. Yeah, she died.
She's buried in Scarborough.
There were five errors on her gravestone.
Really?
Yeah.
Because Anne without an E, or
got the age wrong.
Brilliant.
You know, made out she was the author of Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less. All sorts of stuff. Poor old Anne. The master storyteller. And yeah, where was the respect? Una, was it you? I think you're one of the people who made me read The Tenants of Wildfell Hall.
Yeah, I read when I was on maternity leave. I went a bit mad, and part of the contributory to that was I reread the whole of the Brontes.
The whole of them. Everything.
I did. Yeah, amazing. Just the fiction. I read a load of ancillary.
Not the journals.
Not.
Sorry.
Bus tickets and things. Yeah. Shopping lists. So and Wildfell Hall, I thought was.
That's a great summer project, isn't it? To do the Brontes.
Yeah.
And you was that one of the ones that you
I'd read it before a long time ago. Probably, I think most people read these as teenagers, don't they?
I've never reread Wuthering Heights. So
it's exactly the opening of it is exactly like Rising Damp. It's extraordinary. It really, really is.
I absolutely loved it when I read it when I was 17.
There's fewer hanged dogs. I
reread it a few years ago and felt I'm now too old for it.
Really?
Did you?
Yeah, I found it a bit. But actually, I must say, that is happening to me an awful lot. Now that I'm the grand old age of 44, I'm just not interested in people's romantic mutterings. It's boring.
That thing with the Brontes books is that seems will never settle, which is good, is that different books seem to speak to different audiences in different eras.
Yeah.
And so The Tenant of Wildfell Hall,
The Tenant of Wildfell Hall?
No, it's
social realist about and was very controversial when it was published and was suppressed effectively by Charlotte after Anne's death.
Anyway, what we do? Why?
Hey, John.
Oh, yeah, what have I been reading? Now for something completely different.
What have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a book called Mad Shepherds. This book was given to me by the novelist and general all-round good guy, Ben Myers, because he knew I find it difficult getting up in the dark. Mm. And about the only thing that can coax me out of bed is to read books about nature. This is brilliant. L.P. Jacks is a sort of one of those figures that we don't really have. He's a Unitarian minister, wrote Between the Wars. This book was written in 1910. It's called Mad Shepherds. He knew and lived in the Cotswolds. He was, I think, one of the professor at Manchester College in Oxford, and a writer and a sort of, you know, minor, kind of Shavian figure, sort of philosopher, religious. But this is just bloody brilliant, this book. It's just, if you like... tales of the main character is a shepherd called Snarly Bob, and I'm not going to try and sell it to you. I'm just going to read you a passage because it's the fun. When Snarly Bob met Shepherd Toller at Valley Head, he found him accoutred in a manner which verified his private theory as to the levitation of the kettle. Coiled round Toller's left arm were three slings made from strips of raw oxhide, with pouches, large and small, for hurling stones of various size. Slung over his back was a big bag, also of leather, which contained his ammunition, smooth pebbles gathered from the torrent bed, the largest being the size of a man's fist. Strapped round his waist was a flint axe, the head being a beautiful celt which Toller had discovered long ago on Clundowns and skillfully fixed in a handle with thongs. This is the sentence that I love. In the days of Toller's first madness, it had been his habit to wander over Clundowns equipped in this manner. He had lived in some fastness of his own devising and supplied his larder by the occasional slaughter of a stolen sheep, whose skull he would split with a blow from the flint axe. The slings were rather for amusement than hunting, though his marksmanship was excellent and he was said to be able at any time to bring down a rabbit or even a bird. All day long he would wander in unfrequented uplands, slinging stones at every object that tempted his eye, and roaring and dancing with delight whenever he hit the mark. He was inoffensive enough and had never been known to deliberately aim at a human being, though more than one shooting party had been considerably alarmed by the crash of Toller's stones among the branches or by his long-range sniping of the white-clothed luncheon table. On one occasion, Toller had landed a huge pebble the size of an 8-pound shot into the very bullseye of the feast, to wit, a basket containing 6 bottles of Heidsieck Special Reserve. It was this performance which led Sir George to report the case to the authorities and insist on Toller being put under restraint. It's just... What?
I'm unclear. So, is this fiction or non-fiction?
You know what? I'm still at the end of it. I think it's non-fiction, but I think it's fictionalised non-fiction. It says literature. I mean, it's on in a list. It's published by Oxford University Press. The stories are just, I mean, if you like rural stories of mad shepherds,
yeah.
And Snarly Bob is, of course, the font of all wisdom about these things. It's, and the thing about shepherds is they don't really live in towns. They don't live in anything. They live up on the downs with the sheep. And so it's a kind of, it's a record of a lost world. It's got lots and lots and lots of funny.
I must say, I'm looking at the blurb while you're talking to them. There's some terrific stuff on the blurb. Yeah. Other characters are Shoemaker Hankin.
Yeah.
The parson's wife, who used to be an actress.
Yeah,
a continuous vein of dry humour runs throughout the book, which manages to be absorbing and charming without being over-sentimental.
I have had many... On a week of indifferent weather, I have to say, and dark mornings. I mean, last Monday, I opened the curtains of that thing, and nothing happens when you open the curtains. Is it? The darkness is so absolute outside. It's been a joy. L.P. Jack's Mad Shepherds, published by...
This isn't in print at the moment,
I don't think it is, but if you can find it, I think you might be able to, books it. If you like, tales of eccentric characters from rural life, this is the one for you.
Also, I like the title.
What
should we call this book?
Mad Shepherds.
It's about Mad Shepherds. Let's call it Mad Shepherds.
Brilliant. This book,
great.
For
But
we'll pick this up again after some adverts. Stay tuned to this.
So let us turn to Mrs. Hayer. Miss Hayer?
Miss Hayer. Yeah.
Miss Hayer.
Mrs. Rougier.
Thank you.
It's
first of several corrections that will be occurring.
Or Dame Georgette.
Or Dame Georgette. So, Kathy, you chose this book, Venetia.
Mm.
When did you first encounter this book or Georgette Heyer's novels?
Not when I was very young, which a lot of people I know love Georgette Heyer, sort of read them off their mother's bookshelves when they were 12, etc. My mother thinks this sort of thing is a pile of massive tripe, so I never got a sniff when I was growing up. And somehow I didn't... I'd go to the library and get out all sort of Jean Plaidy, all that kind of thing, historical novels. But again, Georgette Heyer wasn't in Snaith Library, so I sort of missed out. And I think it was when I lived in America for a bit, And I started reading actually American writers writing historical novels set in England, which there is a big, because they all love them. So there's vast amounts of, and they're all in very funny formats, like very small pocketbook paperbacks.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
So this, I can't remember her name now. There's this American writer who wrote books set in kind of 15th century York. So for some reason, it was one of my quirks. While I was living in New York, I would sort of eat these historical novels. And I think by that, I accidentally started reading Georgia Heyer and did very quickly realise this is a completely different... I think she's a completely different case from the rest, you know, the rest of the Regency romances.
Yeah, the phrase Regency romance, I've just... So Regency romance is not... I didn't even know that was a genre... Yeah. Until we started reading this and doing a bit of homework. But and clearly, it's not only is it a genre, it's a huge genre which still sells.
And
Heyer still sells. Is like one of the best-selling authors in the world, still.
Sells sort of like 500,000 copies or something in the last.
So you found these... So you would go out to Central Park, say, or... There was
a Barnes & Noble at the end of my West 21st Street. Yeah. Barnes & Noble, West 21st, it was 24 hour.
Yeah,
I was needing a slightly... this novel never came to anything. I was writing in the night and then sort of finishing at kind of 5 o'clock in the morning with nowhere to go. We go down to the shop and bulk buy these.
He's Georgia Heyer, though.
And,
I mean, utter pleasure, really, once you get the... Once you kind of get into the swing of it,
Before we get to the... Let's continue with the enthusiastic, informed part of the show rather than the bemused men. Una, when did you... Can you remember the first Georgia Heyer that you read?
Crumbs. I think it might have been Venetia, actually. Yeah, it was Venetia or Friday's Child, which I think is her best one. And I also didn't read them as a teenager. My mum was too busy watching Charles Bronson films, so there's no Georgia Heyer. And... I came to her because I've got a writer that I love a lot, a science fiction writer called Lois Bujold, and in front of one of her books she has a little epigram, and it's to Georgette, Jane, Dorothy and Charlotte. And it's Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte. It's Dorothy Dunnett, who's a historical
romance.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, fantastic. And Georgette Heyer. And so my friends who were sort of pressing books on me, and I was doing a PhD, which meant I needed a lot of things to be doing that weren't that. So I kind of started to read her books. But I think Venetia was the first one. Yeah,
well,
my 20s.
I've been really aware that when we've told people that we were going to be doing this, that actually it's really encouraging when you see loads of people responding and saying, oh, I love Georgette Heyer, I can't wait to hear this. And the enthusiasm for her. Yeah.
You know, from Sarah Churchwell.
Yes, often we get Sarah Churchwell.
American literature to Indian Eye.
Yeah.
Harriet Evans is a big fan. Quite often there's a little Georgette Heyer joke buried in one of her novels.
A.S. Byatt is a big fan.
A.S. Byatt, that's right.
John, did you enjoy reading this?
I did really enjoy it. I mean, you know, with a slight... I guess, you know, you have that thing of... slightly surprised that I'd never really thought about reading a Georgette Heyer before, because it's... I mean, I love historical fiction, and I do like... Dorothy Dunnett is somebody who I've read and enjoyed in the past, but I just think she's just very, very good at what she does. I mean, I can't say that it's, you know, made me reassess, you know, the function of fiction in my life, but it pure kind of chicken soup.
Yeah.
I was saying earlier, maybe, you know, that fantasy you always have of just locking yourself away in a room and reading the whole of P.G. Woodhouse. I can imagine sitting there and serially...
I think of her like Woodhouse. Yeah. I don't think of her as the leader of the Regency romance genre. For me, she sits on my kind of comfort comic novel shelves. Yeah. So Georgette Heyer, Woodhouse, Map and Lucia, I Capture the Castle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For me, she's in that space.
Are they more or less, I think she's at least as good as War. When you read a lot of them, I mean, do they become predictable? You know,
the outcome of Venetia
is pretty well told.
She subverts the form a lot as well. Yeah. And I think she's a comic novelist. She continually jokes about the form. So quite often the heroine turns out to be not the heroine you're expecting. So, for example, The Talisman Ring, which is another really great one, there's a sort of an obvious young couple. And then there's this kind of other romance that's happening very much off stage. That's done with a wink to the older
Black
reader.
Black Sheep does that as well, doesn't
Black
it?
Sheep, I love Black
I,
Sheep.
I must say, yeah. I mean, I'd never. I'll tell you exactly what I knew about Georgette Heyer before we did this, and it was classic. Sorry, Waterstones, but it was a classic Waterstones thing. So I ran the fiction section in Waterstones, Kensington High Street, for a couple of years. And all I knew about Georgette Heyer, apart from the fact that they were then published as A formats by Mandarin in the early 1990s,
that's
right. All I knew about her was that she'd written a book called These Old Shades.
Oh, yes.
Because my floor manager, Andrew Vickery, would go, have you got These Old Shades? I can't find These Old Shades. And it was a running joke between us. This is how we passed the time on lates until 9 o'clock at night. I'm making jokes about These Old Shades. But that's all I knew about her.
Well, it's no surprise that was the book that you'd heard of. I think that...
That's the one I mentioned to you, wasn't it?
It's a gateway one, I think. It's the one that was...
Gateway, I love it. Her first big book, wasn't it, These Old Shades?
Yeah, and it's
I can't say that
laugh. That's not one of my favourites, actually.
It's an early one, isn't it? It's a little bit
It's arch and camp and... Yeah. Not that there's a necessarily bad thing
to be... It's phenomenal fun.
Yeah, it is lots of fun.
Some cross-dressing.
So, should we...
Blurb.
Should we do the blurb first, or should we have a flavour of it first? I am going to read the two blurbs, because they're both short. I've got a blurb from a 1970s edition of Venetia, and then I've got the blurb on the current edition, and there is a really fascinating... For once, there is a fascinating difference between these two.
For blurbs. Once.
So I'm going to read, for once, exactly. So this is the 70s blurb. Here we go. Lord Damerel found Venetia to be the most truly engaging and wittily perverse female he had encountered in all his 38 years. Venetia knew her neighbour for a gamester, a shocking rake, and a man of sadly unsteady character. That's on my passport. It was, therefore, particularly provoking to find that, given occasion, Damerel could make up his mind to be quite idiotically noble. Mark of ellipsis. So that's the 70s one.
Yeah, which doesn't actually make a great deal of sense.
Here is the contemporary one, and we can place spot the difference. There's a very significant difference. In all her 25 years, lovely Venetia Lanyon has never been further than Harrogate, nor enjoyed the attentions of any but her two wearisomely persistent suitors. Then, in one extraordinary encounter, she meets a neighbour she only knows by reputation, the infamous Lord Damerel, and before she realises it, finds herself egging on a libertine whose way of life has scandalised the North Riding for years. What is the difference between those two blurbs, everybody?
Well, I would say that Venetia took more of a centre stage on the second one, and that Damerel is the focus of the first.
I would also say that in the later one, the blurb is catching up with the intent of the book.
Yeah.
Rather than the other way around. Right. And that is why I think Georgia Hare is amazing. And also, I'm not surprised A.S. Byatt likes her, because one of my other favourite novels of all time, if I can go a bit off topic, is Possession.
Yep. Mm.
And a lot of Possession is about people, particularly... Ellen Ashe, giving a false idea of herself through her journals.
Yes. Mm.
And I think that is so much of what Georgette Heyer is doing in her novels, is she's I'm the queen of Regency romances, whatever, but she's also continually joking and telling jokes and doing something completely other.
I found it very witty, I must say, which I wasn't expecting. So when I started reading it, I thought, oh, well, okay, this is quite Jane Austen, isn't it? But it's easier than Jane Austen.
Yeah.
I wonder what else it's going to do. And actually, you're right, Kathy. She assumes the reader will be familiar with that.
Yeah.
And then she starts doing subtle but interesting things with it to keep you
and
reading.
Assumes
and keep
that
you...
the reader knows her books as well, I think. Is it, you know, late on in her career, that you've read a lot of Heyer. What's she going to come up with this time? I'm 3/4 of the way through. How's she going to get them together? But so each time she's having to think up a new trick. And I think on the whole, she does do it.
I also really think one of the things I really liked about this book as it went on is you've definitely got, it's a story about Venetia, the rake, Lord Damerel, and Venetia's brother, Aubrey, who is lame, right? And she presents to you your sympathies are with these three outsiders.
Yeah.
You're constantly being shown how they can't be free in this very restricted society in which they've been born. Mm. And they almost form like a separate family group.
Mm.
You've got like Venetia as the mother, Damerel as the father, and Aubrey as the son. And I was also thinking, only once does she use the word libertine in relation to Damerel. But libertine is the right word. It's that it's liberty, it's freedom. Mm. He wants to be free to do what he wants to do. Venetia wants to be free to marry who she wants or not marry.
And the arrival of the marriage is what disrupts the household. The arrival of Conway's bride is what completely kicks that into touch and it breaks that up. It sort of disestablishes what's going on, and it means they have to move away from the house where they're living in this fantasy into some sort of different settlement, I think. Conway is one of my absolute favourite characters in many, many books.
This is Venetia's elder brother.
Because it was very, very close to the end of reading it the first time that I went, he's not going to turn up, is he?
he's not
in this book, and yet you know him. You know this dreadful man. You completely capture.
I agree.
See him punting on the cam. And,
very
you know,
funny as well. I mean, keeping him off stage, again, as I say, very witty thing to do. Kathy, have you got... can you give us a flavour of the...
Yes, I'll read a bit. One of the other things I think she just does spectacularly is she's so good at terrible characters. She's really brilliant at mansplaining, actually. Loads of mansplaining throughout all her books. There's actually
Yardley.
Great...
Yardley. Yeah,
Edward Yardley is a massive mansplainer. What? And I think she's really good on sort of jealous and annoying troublemakers. And it's another theme across her books. So in this case, Venetia has been looking after the household for her brother, who's away at the wars. And without telling them, his wife, his new wife, they don't know that he's got married. He's married and he has this horrible, awful mother-in-law. Brilliant. And they arrive. Great, they just arrive one day. And so she's talking to Damerel about... And by this time, again, they have this really quite amazing friendship. Their initial quite obvious, cliched courtship has mellowed into this friendship where he advises her on what to do and she listens to him. And Venetia just doesn't understand why Mrs. Scoria is so horrible. And this is what Damerel says to her. One of the advantages of having led a sequestered life is that you've not until now encountered the sort of woman who can't refrain from quarrelling with all who cross her path. She is forever suffering slights and is so unfortunate as to make friends only with such ill-natured persons as soon or late treat her abominably. No quarrel is ever of her seeking. She is the most amiable of created beings and the most long-suffering. It is her confiding disposition which renders her a prey to the malevolent, who from no cause whatsoever invariably impose upon her or offer her such intolerable insult that she is obliged to cut the connection. Have I hit the mark? Pretty well, said Aubrey, grinning wryly.
I always think of Mrs. Scoria as a version of the best villain in English literature, which is Mrs. Norris from Mansfield Park.
Oh, yes.
The evil, evil aunt. But Scoria's just like her and has power, little power, over people and wields it for evil.
And always is sowing the seeds of her own destruction all the time because she just can't let well alone and will eventually be rooted by whoever.
You were talking, Kathy, about Edward Yardley's Yardley-splaining. I've got a really brilliant little bit here that Matt and I were discussing this, but weren't we? We both spotted and made us both laugh out loud. So they're in London. He's visiting Venetia in London, isn't he?
Yeah, he's particularly annoying on that visit, isn't he? Kind of smart.
Yardley laughed heartily, saying how well he knew Venetia's literal mind and promising to show her some places of interest which he ventured to think she might not yet have discovered. He himself had twice visited London, and although on the occasion of his first visit he had been too much amazed and bemused to do more than stare about him, when he came for the second time, he provided himself with an excellent guidebook. The idea in which he sees I've been twice and I've got a guidebook. Let me squire you round.
You're merely living.
Yeah.
There's another brilliant bit where he says to her, allow me to know that I know you better than you know yourself.
So she does another thing. I was very grateful. I promised I would mention this. My friend Catherine Musket, a.k.a. Complete Reader, on Twitter, sent me an essay that she'd written for her degree about Georgette Heyer and intertextuality. Mm-hmm. And she had, as luck would have it, Venetia was the book that Catherine focused on. This essay is really good, and it's full of interesting bits and pieces. And I just want to read this. Listen to this. She spots that Heyer has a thing that she likes doing in her novels of having characters quote Shakespeare to one another without ever acknowledging to the reader that that's what they're doing, presupposing that the reader will understand what the reference is. And she says, but in Venetia, she says, it reaches a peak. In addition to the Shakespearean references, the novel features quotations from the Bible, Byron, Ben Jonson, Aubrey, Congreve, Campion, Marlowe, Drayton, Pope, and Samuel Johnson, many of them italicised but unidentified. Nevertheless, Heyer's protagonists respond to Shakespearean quotations with perfect comprehension, apparently enjoying a remarkable familiarity with the complete works of Shakespeare and behaving as though quotation was an entirely natural feature of conversation. No matter how obscure the play, Shakespeare is so well known to the person she is writing for, Heyer implies, that he needs no introduction or explanation.
Yes,
and it's a mark of taste and a mark of quality, I think.
But also, though, it doesn't matter if you didn't know, it wouldn't alter your enjoyment of it, which is what I think, that's the thing. On the one hand, you could just want to read a Regency romance and you would read this and really enjoy it. But then on the other hand, there's all these other levels. Yeah. And I think that rather than, I always used to, I like them actually, but you know when you read detective, I think P.D. James has always got that Adam Dalgliesh annoyingly quoting Shakespeare at characters who then annoyingly quote Shakespeare
and
back.
And Harriet Fain, and they
don't half like hit you over the head with it because they're always having to explain to you how clever they are. Yeah. But there's none of that here. It's seeded gently through so that the knowledgeable reader can think, oh, Cherry Ripe, how nice. Mm. But if you don't get that, it doesn't matter and you're not excluded as a reader. I think it's a bit of it as well that I really like.
As a side note to this, one of her detective novels, Envious Casca, which I think is, I don't know where it's from, is it from Julius Caesar? It's been reissued, but they've changed the title and taken off the Shakespeare quotation.
Christmas party, they just
reissued it without that. So no longer do we assume that her readers will be familiar with Shakespeare.
Though I think in that case, they just wanted to bring it out as a Christmas detective novel.
Yeah, that's true. To be fair.
What I have to say, amongst many things that I loved about the book, the 18th century slang that she uses is fabulous. Yeah. So just a little bit here of, this is Damerel. You know, the banter between Damerel and Venetia is kind of the heart of the book, really. They get on extremely well from the get-go, apart from the unfortunate, you know, kiss, which not that unfortunate, but anyway, I love this. He's talking about some aunts. They're bent on re-establishing me. There are three of them, and they're all antidotes. Two are unmarried and live together. One's fubsy-faced, and t'other's a squeeze crab, and the eldest is a widow, and the most intimidating female you ever beheld. She lives in a mausoleum in Grosvenor Square, rarely stirs out of it, but holds the receptions, very like the Queen's drawing rooms. She's clutch-fisted, dressed like a quiz, has neither wit nor amiability, and yet by means unknown to me, unless it be by force of character, and I'll allow she has that, has persuaded the ton that she is a second Lady Cork, to whose salons it is an honour to be invited. She sounds very disagreeable. She is very disagreeable. A veritable dragon. But there's a lot in a short space.
I'm going to say a bit about the little potted biography of Georgette Heyer, because we should talk a little bit about the things that she was famous for in her writing lifetime as well, because they are very relevant to what we're talking about in terms of that detail, John. You know? So Georgette Heyer is born in 1902 and she dies in 1974. She's the eldest of three children. Her first novel, The Black Moth, based on her younger brother's haemophilia, was published in 1921 when she was 19. And her father died in 1925, leaving Georgette Heyer with financial responsibility for the whole family. And in 1926, she's already... So how old is she? She's like 24. She releases her sixth novel, the aforementioned These Old Shades. And it's a Georgian romance, and it's the making of her. It sells 190,000 copies, despite no reviews or advertising because of the general strike, which is occurring at the same time, with the result that because it sold so many copies, we don't have any audio of Georgette Heyer to play into the show today, because she gave almost no interviews or did any publicity for the rest of her life.
She absolutely refused, didn't she? Yeah.
And she invents, as we discussed, the Regency romance, and she was a ferocious researcher. So the books are full of very specific primary research that she found not just in books. She had like a library of 1,000 books, but also private letters that she would buy at auction to try and squirrel out particular details about costume or language. And she was active in the courts pursuing other writers who had ripped her off, and she could often prove that they were using language which she had uncovered specifically in a private letter. But she didn't always get very good reviews. I have a reference to her here as mistress of the sheerest kind of romantic fluff. And she wrote an essay for Punch, I don't know if you've read this, called How to Be a Literary Critic. This is her response to some of those reviews. If when you are first handed the latest work of one whom you suspect to be your literary superior, you feel that it would be effrontery for you to criticise, do not decline to do so. Remember that no qualifications are necessary for a literary critic, and that furthermore, this is the day of the little man, when the more insignificant you are and the more valueless your opinions, the greater will be your chance of obtaining a hearing. So I think she sort of cared and didn't care, didn't she? I mean, she sold these like vast
really
quantities.
She really harboured ambitions to be... I mean, she writes five or six literary novels really at the start, and then she suppresses them later. You can't get them. You're probably tracking through the library or something, but these don't... You know, you can't get them. They're not reissued. And then she does a book called Penhallow. Which she sort of, clearly in her mind, she thinks that this is going to be the thing that establishes her as a literary writer. And the problem with Penhallow is it's shit. It's a really bad book.
I read somewhere, and I don't remember where, I thought Penhallow, it was purposefully bad because she wanted to break her contract with that publisher.
My impression was she did, well, no, no.
That's
she,
what I, that's,
really
I don't know where I have that
it.
Information from.
And I,
but
I
that's
think
where...
she's going to be, you know, she thinks it's going to be, but it's a terrible, terrible book.
It's an awful novel, yeah.
But then what she does, and it's not badly reviewed, but what she, it's tepidly reviewed, and I think it's not the breakout book. And then after that, it's just Regencies. But the next book is Friday's Child, and that's brilliant.
And is that the breakout Regency book for her, then?
No, These Old Shades is the breakout.
Yeah, right.
But after Penhallow, the crime drops off, there's no more literary, it's just the Regencies. Mm. But she really, you know, she's not a very likeable person.
She does. You're right, she doesn't come across as terribly likeable. There's a brilliant quote here about how annoyed she was. She's constantly being harassed for tax.
Yeah,
she's
constantly
having tax problems.
Hey, she writes Venetia to pay a tax bill.
Does she, right? Yeah, says here, she said, oh, these tax bills, she says. This is in a letter to her lawyer. I'm getting so tired of writing books for the benefit of the Treasury. And I can't tell you how utterly I resent the squandering of my money, underlined, on such fatuous things as education. And making life easy and luxurious for so-called workers. I mean, I think we can guess.
Time has come again, Andrew.
She took back control.
She hated the modern age, didn't she? She would often inveigh against the wretched time to be alive. I mean, she despised the whole sort of the industry of publicity and you know, authors talking about their work.
She was very concerned about doing a good job. And obviously very concerned about sales.
John was talking about the use of slang. She's so... there's like, I must try and work into my everyday...
Funny.
Her euphemisms for drunk are brilliant. Like, she's obviously found, like, a list somewhere of art. Like, she says... He released her, pressing his hands over his eyes. Hell and the devil, I'm jug-bitten.
Yeah.
I'm drunk as a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
I've eaten, and his valet says, look out, Miss Venetia, he's eaten Hull cheese.
Yeah. I discovered that Banbury Story, I'd never heard of Banbury Story before, and a Banbury Story was the original cock and bull story, a sort of a Banbury story of a cock and bull. So without suggesting that it remotely smells of the lamp, because she does make it work, I don't know. What I was most reminded of was sort of Jane Austen. In fact, Rachel, who my wife is a big fan, she said they're a bit like straight to DVD sequels to Jane Austen.
That she happily identified her two types of male hero. Do you know this?
No.
Mark One and the Mark Two. And the Mark One is a sort of Rochester / Heathcliff figure, and the Mark Two is more of a Darcy.
Yeah.
Right, and she wrote...
And Oswald and Yardley think that they're Mark 1 and Mark 2.
But she knew... The thing is, she knew that, and she was...
Yeah.
She wrote another essay called Books About the Brontes, funnily enough, given in Sam Ellis's book that we were talking about. And she said this about Charlotte Bronte. She said, Charlotte Bronte knew, perhaps instinctively, how to create a hero who would appeal to women throughout the ages, and to her must all succeeding romantic novelists acknowledge their indebtedness. For Mr. Rochester was the first and the nonpareil of his type. Very Heyer word, that, the nonpareil of his type. He is the rugged and dominant male who can yet be handled by quite ordinary a female, as it might be oneself! He is rude, overbearing, and often a bounder, but these blemishes, however repulsive they may be in real life, can be made in the hands of a skilled novelist extremely attractive. Charlotte Bronte, immensely skilled, knew just where to draw the line. Mm. And actually, I think that's the brilliant thing, Kathy, about Heyer, that she, as you were saying, she takes things that you sort of feel familiar and then makes them much better than they need to be and funnier.
The hero's not turning out how they're supposed to be. The rakes are always very ready to be reformed as well, which is...
Or not quite as rakish as reputation
Not quite
has.
As racist, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of...
Daniel turns out to be a thoroughly decent human being, doesn't
yes.
he?
Yes.
I mean, it is to some extent predictable. You know, you can see what's going to happen. I mean, we were talking earlier about them being unpopular. We were saying Germaine Greer didn't like them. Mm-hmm. And I can sort of see it. They're either strong feminist kind of heroines, or they're slightly, you know, the kind of feminist heroines that aren't that feminist, really, because in the end...
I doubt they stand up to a feminist reading, do they? Which, personally, I don't care about.
Excellent. But they've been somewhat reclaimed, haven't they? That's what's interesting about these things. Mm. Like we were saying about the Brontes earlier, that Germaine Greer is very dismissive of them. Carmen Khalil, very dismissive of them. Mm. Carmen Khalil says she basically just rejigged the plot of Jane Eyre 57 times.
But did she read 57 books? I bet she didn't.
She didn't.
You know,
exactly.
That's the thing when...
But then that generation were around when she was alive, and there might well be a case, I think, you know, that it takes... This is a very Welbeckian idea. that what happens is critics never change their mind. Yeah, yeah. They just die, and then another generation of critics comes up and takes their place.
I think this is the first time Welbeck and Georgette Heyer have been...
Not bookended
in a
probably
podcast.
Probably never when Miller and I are on the chat.
It's true. Very true.
I mean, I do think you would have to have a sort of, you know, as they say, a heart of stone not to... I mean, to just sheer pleasure of... The, you know, she's a very good storyteller, a master storyteller.
I really enjoyed it.
I mean, the moment where the wife arrives, Conway's wife, she kind of puts an appearance in. You pull back from the book and you go, that is bang on halfway.
Yeah.
And now we've turned the motor and we're off again. I think you said something about three quarters of the way through. Yeah. She's not messing about. This is a fine tune.
So why this one, Kathy?
Yes, good question.
Well, they're not all good. Some of them are peculiar. Yeah. So I have a kind of a handful of favourites. And actually, it was just this was the one I fancied rereading most.
Great.
Because I read them again and again and again. I read them all the time. I've got a shelf of them. And usually, because I can't read new things before going to sleep, because if it's any good, I don't go to sleep. I stay up all night reading it, which is obviously nice on a one-off, but... It's not actually achievable in general.
I love these readings, like me having to read consoling tales of rural life to get me out of bed in the morning, and you having to read books you've already read.
I do.
The secret story of this podcast is always the secret anguish of reading.
It's entirely true.
I like to think I major in that Kathy is so... You're so good on this topic.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want anyone to feel sorry for us, but when it comes down to it, you know, I was really... It's not my... I hate the phrase, but it's not my comfort zone at all. Mm. So I'm trying to...
Regency Romance is not your bag.
When I started reading it, obviously with the eyes of, I've given Andy and John this to read, I started reading it thinking, like, oh, God, it's awful, and why did I choose this one, and I should have chosen something else, and then I just got into it and thought, oh, fuck it. It's okay, you know?
Or gammon.
I'm so pleased as well, I must add, and this is true, I'm so pleased to have read it. Mm. I mean, not to have finished it, but I mean to have be someone who's ready.
I'm interested that it would never have occurred to us to read a Georgette Heyer, and why that is, and why the fact that there are boys' books and girls' books at all seems to me to be curious, and that I'm absolutely struck by how many really really smart women who've gone on to be writers or academics, absolutely. You know, when you say Georgette Heyer, they go, yes, I love her.
I think she's right on that list of books that loads of people will slag off without never having been anywhere near.
Yeah.
Which, let's face it, is a long list.
And I think she was read by men during her lifetime. I think she was. I think she was read as a historical novelist. Yeah.
I always just have this idea that she researches so well. I mean, I don't know whether she gets the stuff right about the steel foundries or Stevenson's Rocket or whatever it is, and I'm sure it's not Stevenson's Rocket because, again, it's not the sort of detail I noticed, so I wouldn't remember it. But there's loads of stuff in that, and also there's quite often, I think it's in that one where you've got a lazy aristo and his the sort of the eager young man who is his secretary is trying to make him take an interest in parliamentary matters and he won't. You know, that all those sorts of things. So there's always this very nicely done background.
When we were talking about her on Twitter, and maybe it was Complete Reader, she said she was a man's woman. She liked the company of men. There's a lovely quote, A.S. Byatt quotes, Heyer knows the ways in which men of birth used up their energy when they weren't fighting wars. She knows all about, and this is apparently what men do, sheep breeding, the new crops of turnips, Swedes and mangelwurzels, about coke of Norfolk, Tull's drill, manures and rotation of crops. And this is what men do, apparently.
Yeah, it's true. That's very interesting, that idea that she was published, that what was interesting about her books in publishing terms, and presumably therefore was a big part of her success, was this conspicuous... Sorry, all these words are loaded. Conspicuous it sounds pejorative in some way. I don't mean it to be. This conspicuous research. She did the research and she puts it on the page for the reader.
Yeah.
And that's part of the pleasure of reading them. I wonder if the equivalent in male terms to some extent, and I'm sure people who are listening to this will disagree, but I wonder if it's rather like Patrick O'Brien. That the presentation of both research and seeming authenticity is part of the appeal.
Men read O'Brien.
No, I don't think that. But I don't think that. No, let me clarify what I mean. That's part of the appeal of Patrick O'Brien's books.
I think you're right. I think that there's a cumulative. I can see why you would want to read more than one. Because I think there's a sort of, like O'Brien, that's a really good comparison. There's a sort of cumulative effect that there's a whole. I mean, you know, she's mistress of this world. Also,
I think the wives bought them and the husbands read them. Yeah. And with O'Brien, the husbands.
I would also say, I think she's, you know, when she's, you know, she's a good writer. There's just a little paragraph here which I noticed. I thought anyone would be pleased to write a paragraph like this. Aubrey remained for 10 days at the Priory, and even the weather conspired to make them halcyon days for his sister. There was only one wet and chilly day in all the 10. And then the gold of the mellowing landscape crept into the house, for Damrell had a fire kindled in the library, and its light, flickering over the tool backs of the volumes that lined the room from wainscot to cornice, made them glow like turning leaves. That's pretty good.
It's pretty nice. I must say, my editor would have been very cross with her pen about the fact that there are 3 days or day in quite quick succession, which I never used to notice that sort of thing until the brilliant Francesca Main has made me hyper aware of
it. It's true.
The repetition of words. There's another really nice passage here about, it's a very short description of London at night.
Yes.
It seemed as though no one ever went to bed in London.
Yeah.
And whenever during a lull in the apparently endless flow of traffic she dropped off to sleep, she was very soon jerked awake by the voice of the watchman, proclaiming the hour and the state of the weather. She could only suppose that the ears of Londoners had been bludgeoned into insensitivity and trust that her own would soon grow accustomed to the ceaseless racket. And being a well-mannered girl, presently assured her aunt that she had passed an excellent night and was feeling perfectly restored from the effects of her journey.
Oh, that's great.
That's nice. Isn't that good?
Cathy and Una, if we were minded to press ahead with Georgette Heyer, should we read other of her Regency romances? Mm-hmm. Should we read her crime? Should we read her novels set in other periods of history?
Her journals?
The
Regency, the best Regency romances are the best ones. Yeah. I'd say Frederica is very good. Also, False Colours, which is very interesting. It has identical twins who change places. Identical twin boys who are both 24. And again, there's all sorts of manly stuff.
What's
about
that called? Did you say False Colours?
False Colours. And one of them is very much in the petticoat line. And until he has to marry a girl called Cressida Staveley to save his mother. His mother is she's terribly in debt. So he has to save the scandal of his mother. He has to get married so that he can release the trust. And he has to marry this girl. But he goes off to finish with the ladybird in Tunbridge Wells that he's been shacked up with. And then he has an accident. And his brother, who's a diplomat, has to step in and pretend to be him for a bit. And then, of course, they all start falling in love with different people. It's very funny.
I have to say that. You've made that sound absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I'll see you back here in a fortnight. Yeah.
And the Talisman Ring as well. That's a favourite of mine. That involves smugglers
Yeah. Have you got a favourite?
My favourite is Friday's Child, which is about a bunch of very young, very rich airheads who get married sort of by accident on the first page, and pretty much, and then have to sort of make it work. Money helps, and that's hilarious.
That is so funny.
Again, just really well crafted, and it just...
And again, that's a very good one. The heroine is not, because there is a beauty called Isabella Milbourne, who, and people are always fighting duels over her, but she's not the heroine. The heroine is the small, scruffy, poor girl. Mm. And then there's a fabulous sort of abortive elopement that, again, just takes the piss out of the whole genre magnificently.
And the circle of friends.
Brings it all around beautifully. Well, the circle of friends, Ferdy and Gil and all that lot. It's so
fantastic.
Funny.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. I have to tell our listeners that Mitch is sitting here reading Georgia Heyer to himself.
I just thought... She's a great one for the testy pup. I love that. Obstinate whelp.
There's also, just in case you don't read the others, because of course this one is set very... The whole point about it is Venetia has never really gone further than Harrogate. And although they go to London briefly, you don't get much of it. But actually the ones set in London where you have the court and you have balls and all that sort of thing, and the other ones where people go to the country and then they go to Bath to take the air. So all that stuff. And I think it's one of the reasons why it is satisfying to obsessively reread them again and again and again, because of all sorts of personal peculiarities, is because there is this interconnected world.
Yeah.
So you read something in one that will explain the reference you didn't quite get in the other one about watering holes or whatever. Yeah. So it adds up and up and up and up.
Dr. McCormack, is there Georgette Heyer fanfic?
Oh, God, yes. Good heavens, yeah. There's Middlemarch fanfic.
Of course there is, yeah. Of course there is.
I don't know, I'm just getting old, but I found Venetia quite alluring as a female.
Did you? Yeah, I did. It's her laughing voice.
Mm. Maybe.
She says a lot of things laughingly.
Do you have a very lowering reflection? Do you know what it is? I think I'm older than Damerel.
Yeah.
I'm definitely older than Damerel.
He's 38.
Yeah, I know. I mean, a child. But of course, when I first read this book, he was sort of a
impossibly
middle-aged
old
man.
Yeah.
And now the libertine John Mitchinson will sign us out.
I think we should all twirl our cravats.
But I think we're all giving ourselves, we're all sort of, you know, throwing our hats in the air and saying gammon. And
we are throwing our hats in the air, I agree.
Yeah, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I honestly don't think we would have probably got to Georgette Heyer without your firm push, Kathy.
So I shall go to my grave a happy woman, hopefully not too soon. I don't think it's in here, but can I just share my favourite... I use this for describing my own relationship with inebriation. Can I tell you my favourite Heyerism?
Yes.
I'm three parts disguised. Obviously, I'm not at the moment, but who knows?
She's good. It's good. It's lovely. I suppose that's probably a good point to pull the curtains, the damask screens. Thanks to Una McCormack, to Kathy Rensenbrink, to our producer Matt Hall, and thanks once again to our sponsors Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at BacklistedPod, on Facebook BacklistedPod, and on the Unbound website, unbound.com/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode in a fortnight.
Until then, farewell.
You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of 2 episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.